All right, everyone, welcome to another That's a Dive. I'm Kyle Martino, and big announcement, back on the pod, producer Ore, PJ's back in the house. Where were you?
I was down in Louisville for the Kentucky Derby.
Off to bigger and better things.
Went down for a week, go talk to the horses, because unlike some people, Kyle, the horses, when I talk to them, they listen.
But we both have a lot of hair.
We do. We do. Now people can really see it in person.
I meant me and the horses, but you've got some good hair.
That's true.
Yeah. Who won the Kentucky Derby?
Always Dreaming.
Was that the favorite?
He was going into the, when the race started, yes.
The Tad Potters right now are like, we don't care about the Kentucky Derby. We want to get into the pod. Yeah. We're going to get into it in a second. We're going to talk about a lot going on. I've got three good topics today, but before I do that, let's get into the reviews. Love the reviews, and as I always say on the pod, I have no idea why they help, but they just do. So keep hitting us with reviews. Not only do we love them, they're funny, they're awesome, even the bad ones, but they bump us up on some list that makes it easier to see us. It's science. But here are my three favorites from this week. And what we've been doing, if you're listening again, you know what we've been doing. But if this is your first time in the Tab Pod, welcome. And drop us a review. And what we love to do, which is a lot of fun, is drop a little movie reference in there, because we're pop culture junkies, and we love to try and guess what the movie references are. So the first one is Lord Farquhar. I'm not going to spell that. I think I was pretty close. 96. In the last pod, I could hardly hear the talking because of all the noisy hair scratching, thus proving that bald is best. So, Mr. Martino, how do you like them apples? Crushing us with an amazing Good Will Hunting reference. Good Will Hunting, whenever that's on, I have to watch it all the way through. I mean, yeah. It's basically like a rule.
It doesn't even matter where it is in the movie. You can pick it up almost any time.
Yeah, yeah. It's a shame. It's almost like when someone starts shaving a haircut and you have to finish the song, which is a weird reference. All right, let me move on to the next one. Hooked is the subject by Capo 40858561 2. I mean, was 40858561 taken? They had to throw in the 1-2 at the end?
I can't tell if they were trying to give, like, in a weird way, give you...
Is that a phone number?
Their phone number, yeah.
I might be missing a digit. Anyway, I tell all my friends about this great pod. Remember it. Write it down. Take a picture. I don't give a F. Asterisks. Are we allowed to swear on this pod? I think it's probably frowned upon.
Yeah. Well, you gotta avoid it.
He didn't swear in his review.
We have spelled once, which...
We spell out
which,
the swear?
Which was pushing it.
Like I do with my 2-year-old?
Yes.
Yeah. Perfect.
Although that pushed the limits.
She's getting close to being able to figure that one out.
That's Chris Tucker, by the way.
I didn't know that one. From Friday?
Yeah.
See, that's why you're here, PJ. Welcome back. Kentucky Derby didn't love you as much as we do. Last one. Han and Chewie Say the Soccer Universe by Hank the Tank 21. This is the best sidekick duo since Riggs and Murtaugh? Does that pronounce that right?
Yeah.
I mean, I love that. I know that one. That one's Star Wars. Better than Turner and Hooch. I don't know what type of dog Hooch was, but I wanted to get one after that, even though he drooled everywhere. That was such a good movie. But not by much, he says. I think the best salute I can give to this pod is Han and Chewie. Kyle the suave and cocky hero who saved the rebellion. PJ the, well, if you've seen his arm hair, you know why he is Chewie. Do you have a lot of arm hair? You always wear long sleeve shirts,
well,
I'm noticing.
Yeah, I try to
you
conceal
hide
them? It. Yeah. I try to conceal
they
it.
They have laser for that.
Mm-hmm.
You can just get it all removed.
Yeah, I thought about it.
The whistle is the greatest innovation, which, by the way, is back on this pod. Since the shot clock, this pod is going places. I bet Kyle and PJ sit around asking each other, okay, on the count of three, name your favorite Premier League goalkeeper. Don't even think about it. Just do it. 1, 2, 3.
Arthur Birch.
That's Step Brothers.
We just become best friends.
That's Step Brothers. Yeah. Oh, Step Brothers is so good. So that's another one when it's on, you have to watch it all the way through.
They got a few quotes under that one. And also, just this, I think this is a reference to a previous review where they compared us to another Star Wars analogy where they compared us to Luke and Han. And I think this person did not think that was accurate, so they decided to.
Yeah, he wanted to one up.
Bring up my arm hair.
I mean, there are so many Star Wars references we can go a whole season. Keep with the Star Wars references.
Exactly.
And keep with the reviews. We love them. You guys are the best. All right, topics this week, the three of them. First, but not first in order, first that I'm going to say, Jermaine Jones. Jermaine Jones is hurt. What does that mean for Bruce Arena and the U.S. national team? And it's a contentious topic that keeps popping up. The next one, Manchester United, Jose Mourinho. Update, where are we? Is this successful? is this not successful? What do Manchester United fans think of this season? Well, we'll say what we think of the season under Jose Mourinho. And then first topic, Chelsea. They're going to win a title. They're going to win another title, and they're going to win it a season after being the worst version of Chelsea we've seen in the Premier League era, coming off of a title, which is mind-boggling. I mean, last season, as much as you know about Jose Mourinho and his sort of third season syndrome that we always talk about. It doesn't always sort of take place in the third season. But the third season typically with Jose Mourinho is when things absolutely blow up. And the reason why is it typically comes after the pinnacle. It comes after delivering success. And success with a Jose Mourinho team has a lot of potholes along the way. There's a lot of fights with high-profile stars. There's a lot of picking fights with the media. There's sort of this natural arc to a Jose Mourinho season where he hits all of these checkpoints, and then when the title comes, there's this the beginning of a remarkable crash. And Chelsea was the worst we've seen it. Chelsea's crash under Jose Mourinho was the worst third season syndrome we've seen for Jose Mourinho. And you know, you if you're looking for the crux of the problem, it's hard to find one individual thing. I honestly think it was when he picked a fight with Eva Caniero, the team doctor. We had on one of our first pods, I talked about the relationship with the physio being so important. I mean, that is one of your biggest advocates in the locker room. And as a player, you have a very intimate, very important relationship with your physio. You tell them things that you don't tell your coach. You look for protection. And honestly, they're the ones that get you back on the field. And you know, as I said, Matt Pod, go back and listen to it. As someone who spent a lot of time injured and had his career taken away by a game-ending, career-ending injury, the physio was the most important person in my life. And when he picked a fight with Ivan Caniero, especially the way he did it publicly, embarrassing her, he lost trust. He lost a lot of trust in that locker room when things were already a bit, coming off of the summer, a bit contentious. And so we saw the thing fall apart. We saw Jose fired around Christmas, right? I think he was fired halfway through the year.
It's right after they lost to Leicester.
And then Gus Hiddink comes in as the stabilizing figure, someone who had been at the club before, who was a safe pair of hands, and stabilized it in the sense that they climbed up. I think, what did they finish, like 10th or something like that? And so it wasn't fixed by any means. It was just kind of stabilized.
Basically made sure they didn't get relegated, which is where it looked.
I mean, they were in a relegation fight.
If Mourinho had stayed on all season, they might have stunk down.
I remember getting in a huge fight with Robbie Musto about this, where I said they are currently in a relegation battle. And Musto, it was more semantics, which is whatever, what always happens with Musto and I when we argue, is he meant they won't end up in a relegation battle. But they were currently in one. So I guess we were both right, but we love to fight. So here they are, moments away from winning the title. Win at West Brom, they win the title, and that's going to happen. So they're gonna win the title this season, and let's just try to unpack it and figure out how. So they bring in Antonio Conte in the offseason, and obviously tremendous success at Juventus, three titles in a row, remarkable success in the Euros with I would say an overachieving Italian team that was not one of the best we've seen in some of these major tournaments recently. And even though it wasn't winning the Euros, how far they got was a major success. Sort of across the board, everyone said that. So he comes in with a lot of clout, a lot of credit, but lands kind of in a mess. I mean, everyone expected Antonio Conte to be able to turn things around. I don't think many people expected him to win the title. I mean, if all of us in the studio, which our title guesses aren't the most stellar, but none of us had Chelsea winning the title. I mean, some of us had Chelsea outside of the top four.
I think the general idea was that if they somehow got into the top four, that would be a successful season for them. And a lot of people didn't think they were going to get there.
No, absolutely. And what you were worried about was the malaise and the sort of systemic issues that were created under Jose Mourinho. Were they going to linger? So if you remember, the fans, You know, it kind of reminds me of when Ranieri was fired. You know, the fans, they struggle with this dilemma. Who am I mad at? Who do I blame? Is this the coach's fault? Is this the player's fault? Everyone kind of wants to assign blame. And I think realistically in these scenarios, the culpability is there. I mean, the blame is shared. And I guess it's more what percentage of blame, where does it go? And if you look at Chelsea's resurgence and Leicester's resurgence, doesn't it justify the decision to get rid of the manager? And that's a longer discussion for another pod. But they bring in a coach who still had issues because the percentage of blame that went onto the players still exists. I remember the Chelsea fans right after Jose Mourinho was fired unfurling a sign, a banner in the stands that they called the players rats. Some of the players rats, and they didn't name them, but I'll name them for you. The players they were talking about were Diego Costa, Eden Hazard, Cesc Fabregas. Look at the league this season. I just named three of their best performers. And Cesc Fabregas, someone who became a nuisance, a thorn in Jose Mourinho's side, if you want to try and read between the lines, because he wasn't being given the role that he enjoyed in the past. He wasn't playing as regularly. He was getting criticism. I think he's only started 11 or 12 games this season. Down the stretch, he's the guy that they're counting on. I mean, he's performing at a remarkable level. Antonio Conte's got him back on side. Diego Costa was still moaning, was still a problem at the beginning of this year, and that culminated with that. Remember that visual of him asking to be substituted and getting in that fight, and Antonio Conte saying, "No, I'm the boss. You're staying out there." We were in the studio looking at that as, okay, here it comes. This is the moment this thing kind of blows up a little bit. And if you also remember, that was during a point in the season where they really weren't dominant. I mean, they were winning games at the beginning of the season kind of in lucky fashion. And it was, you know, don't say it's lucky. Fergie time was sort of created. That term was coined for doing exactly what they did, which is putting on another forward, pushing, pressing, getting a late goal in dramatic fashion. But that papered over a lot of cracks that ended up showing themselves in the Arsenal game when it totally collapsed and he moved to this back three. So if you're going to try and think of all the things that have worked, minor little things like Antonio Conte handling of Diego Costa, giving Eden Hazard freedom instead of what Jose Mourinho did, which is, I want you to have more defensive responsibility. I'm going to push you. Let's be fair to Jose Mourinho. That actually led to him getting PFA Player of the Year. But I think it's clear in the third season, Eden Hazard got tired of that much responsibility. And with Real Madrid and some of the biggest clubs in the world knocking on his door, thought, you know what, I'd probably like to play a little more of a free attacking role. Antonio Conte gives him that role. The system sets him up so he basically can be a player hanging and looking for transition, looking to counterattack, cherry picking almost. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, as I said, Cesc Fabregas and his resurgence. So the switch to back three, the micromanaging and handling of individual players, and I just think the overall, and this is what I said on the show, two words: intensity and integrity. He brings intensity in a different way than Jose Mourinho does, but Jose Mourinho brings incredible intensity, and it's an ingredient in his success. But I just don't think Jose Mourinho brought the integrity side of things that all of the players, all of the staff, all of the fans immediately fell in love with Antonio Conte for.
Do you think with these specific players, Costa, Hazard, Fabregas in particular, even Matic you could throw in there, is it more due to the fact that Conte specifically came in or to the fact that Mourinho was gone?
I think it's a combination. I think we saw immediately with Gus Hiddink, he didn't really do much. He came in and sort of... He was charged with kind of getting smiles back on the players' faces. And he even said it in his first couple press conferences. But there were still defensive issues when Gus Hiddink was there. Mm-hmm. They still didn't look like a dominant team. It just looked like they kind of, more than enjoyed his presence, enjoyed the lack of Mourinho. So that's a part of it. But the majority of it is Antonio Conte. And the attention to detail, which is not dissimilar to Jose Mourinho, the intensity, which is not dissimilar to Jose Mourinho, but the trust. I think players lost trust in Jose Mourinho, which is, I think, what happens in every third season with Jose. When he starts his old tactics of picking on a star player, of attacking the press, it gets old. You know, I think I used an analogy early on in the season that it's like a sitcom star who keeps using his catchphrase, but just doesn't get laughs anymore. You know, it just it, it I think there's an expiration date for Jose Mourinho, and he knows it, and by the way, and it doesn't really bother him because he moves on, he goes somewhere else, and is able to find success at a new club, which will be our next topic when we get into Jose Mourinho. Is he finding success? But as we finish up this Chelsea thing, what's going on right now, a large part of that is Antonio Conte. I'm going to, since you're back, yeah, I mean, it's you being back, you can't reel me in enough.
I mean, if it were Mike, he'd probably tell you to stop right now.
Yeah, he would shut me down.
I'll let you go a little.
Thank you.
I'll give you.
That's why I love you, PJ. Yeah. You're more lenient. So let's just finish it off with a couple key signings. N'Golo Kanté, David Luiz, which you wouldn't have expected. Marcos Alonso, which you wouldn't have expected. The resurgence of Moses, bringing him back from loan. So there are some key signings. There was there is a from top, I mean, we talked about this on the show this weekend, Abramovich, from the top down, there is a, some people don't like it, but the knee-jerk nature of the club is a, we don't put up with mediocrity. Right, the second it rears its ugly head, we make changes. And they have all the titles to suggest that in the modern era, since Abramovich has been there, that's been working. For sure. So here's another example. New coach comes in. They're going to win a title. But the big question is, can they sustain the success into next season? Because a trend that it's only two seasons, but if you take maybe Liverpool's run when they got second place, you could sort of support this idea. Is there a trend towards the teams that don't have the distraction of European football doing well in the Premier League? Because not only is there a legitimate top six where it's harder than ever to win a Premier League title, but the rest of the league is so strong that you just can't afford to take one game off. So here's a season where Chelsea almost never changed their lineup, and they're not going to be able to do that next season. He's not going to have that luxury. And does Diego Costa leave? Does he go to China, as it seems like the reports are suggesting? And I mean, I think there's some veracity to those reports. So the big question is not how they've done it this year. I think we did our best to explain that, is how they continue to do it, and can Antonio Conte do it into next season?
Yeah, I mean, the depth is going to be the biggest question. You brought up the new players he brought in. I think that's important because a lot of people think that he's basically winning the title with the same team Mourinho won with 2 years ago, which isn't true because you just brought it up.
No.
Conte, Alonso, Moses, Luis, where none of those guys were part of the team. They're all regular starters. So that makes me feel confident he's going to be able to bring in more new players next season that can help in the Champions League and other competitions when they do have,
yeah,
when they have to worry about more of a.
The other thing he's bringing in is a number two. He hasn't been able to bring in his own number two yet, as Haaland's leaving to go to coach with Southgate with England. So that's a vacant role, and there's been some of the reports about Antonio Conte leaving already, which is unthinkable, but Inter are coming after him huge with their new Chinese owners. They're going to throw,
they just fired, you know, their manager,
10, 12 million pounds a year to him. So he's going to have to look the other way on that one. But the number two, his assistant, has been a big area of contention. And it looks like as they go on to win the title, they've relented, the board and Roman Abramovich, saying, bring in whoever you want, which, do whatever Antonio Conte wants at this point. You need to keep him. So they're going to win a title. It's pretty remarkable. And it's remarkable because of the mess that they've cleaned up quickly. Who caused that mess? Well, that's Jose Mourinho. And let's move on to another mess that he didn't cause that he's come into. And that's the interesting part before you talk about Jose Mourinho and is this first season at Manchester United a success or a failure. You really have to handicap it for the first time because he's coming into a club that had issues before he got there. I mean, every club he's joined, I mean, even at Porto, but going to going to his first time at Chelsea, Real Madrid, Inter Milan, there were issues, but all of those clubs were close to winning titles before he got there. I mean, all of those clubs were finishing in second and third the year before he got there. And obviously in the situation of Inter and Real Madrid, you're in a league that isn't as difficult to win historically as the Premier League is, especially now. So you have to give Jose a fair handicap when he comes into this job to say this is actually, even though it's Manchester United, one of the biggest clubs in the world with the biggest spending power, probably up there with Real Madrid in the world. It's a challenge. because of things that are not his fault. Louis Van Gaal struggled with it. David Moyes struggled with it. The reality is they're still trying to get their footing after Sir Alex Ferguson. Sir Alex Ferguson was something special that will never happen again. The manager that's all-knowing, all-powerful, that stays there forget 26 years. Was he there for 26 years? Forget that. I mean, 6 years. You're not even going to see a manager stay for 6 years because the landscape's changed. Sir Alex Ferguson did something special, but one thing he did that maybe is the only area he deserves a little criticism is he left a squad that was aging that had gotten every last bit out of it in that last title he won. And one of Sir Alex Ferguson's greatest gift was seeing down the road and what needed to be done. So he deserves a little bit of criticism for what he's left behind. But let's, now that we've given Jose Mourinho some defense, let's be real. They've spent, since Sir Alex Ferguson's left, nearly $500 million. I mean, Paul Pogba, Di Maria, I mean, some of the remarkable, enormous, record-breaking signings that they've made have not panned out.
You brought up Di Maria, Memphis. These guys, they spent a lot of money on. Now they're gone already.
So now a lot of these, save for Pogba, were not Jose Mourinho's decision. But let's not pretend like this isn't a team that's stockpiled with talent. The big issue about this season is they're going to finish outside of the top four. And in all but one season since Sir Alex Ferguson's left, they finished outside of the top four. So if you're going to hire Jose Mourinho, shouldn't that be the first measure? League Cup, don't tell me for a second any of the Manchester United fans care about a League Cup. I know they always talk about their trophies and their trophy count and how important that is to them. Give me a break. The League Cup means nothing to you. That's a red herring. So the big decision this year and the big sort of measuring stick is, are you going to be okay if they finish outside the top four but win the Europa League, which ends up being their path into the Champions League? Manchester United fans, are you going to be okay with that? And most of them will say, yeah. Most of them will say, we've never won the Europa League. It's one trophy that's not sitting in our cabinet. They'll say, you know, I'm okay with him prioritizing that because that's going to get us into the Champions League. But here, I got something for you. What if they lose to Ajax in the final? Forget that. What if they lose in the second leg at Old Trafford? What if Celta Vigo come in, and even though they were terrible in the first leg, walk out of there 2-0? It's not as if they've been great at Old Trafford. And by the way, that's one of the biggest problems under Jose Mourinho is they are difficult to watch at Old Trafford. This remarkable unbeaten run that they've been on, what was it, 25 games before Arsenal beat them? Something like that, 26 games?
It's very overrated.
Yeah, it was so remarkable that it moved them from sixth place to fifth place. I mean, that unbeaten run was as remarkable as a world record walking 100 meter. I mean, that it's so difficult to sit and look at how poor Manchester United are, especially at Old Trafford, but in general, attacking wise. So. Everyone will want to show the stats of how many shots they've had and the games that they've lost. They've created plenty of chances. But that Arsenal game that we saw recently, I think even though he quote-unquote put out a weakened side, which, give me a break, that wasn't a weakened side. Save for Twanzebe, that was every one of those players, when he had a full squad to pick from this season, were starters at one point or another. The style is a problem. In that game, playing a back four and using Juan Mata and Henrik Mkhitaryan as basically wing backs to make a back six, yeah, is impossible to watch. And listen, if it wins titles, fans will deal with it, as he did at Chelsea. And listen, it wasn't all defensive at Chelsea or at Real Madrid or some of these other teams. I mean, he Real Madrid, he had the scoring record, right? They had the most goals in La Liga. And at Chelsea, they were remarkable attacking teams at times. But Jose Mourinho is a pragmatic, especially in big games, conservative coach. So if that doesn't win you a title, if that doesn't get you into Champions League, and all of a sudden this summer, players like Kylian Mbappe and Griezmann are watching that game and saying, "You got to be kidding me! I'm going to go to Manchester United so I can be a wingback in a back six." It's not going to happen. And Kylian Mbappe, by the way, supposedly in L'Equipe, said as much, said, I'm not interested in the style at Manchester United. So Manchester United fans, would it be a success this season if you get to Champions League through Europa League, win a title, but you've got to go to Old Trafford or in big matches, watch a stuttering, slow, languid, conservative Manchester United? I mean, it's painful.
Yeah, I mean, you just brought up, you know, 51 goals scored this season. The top four had them all have 70 or more. I mean, that's a huge gap, and that's a big reason why I think that unbeaten streak was so misleading, because they had so many draws. They have 14 draws this season. You're better off losing a couple games and changing some of those other ones into wins where you're actually going to get more points. So having an unbeaten streak where you have where half of them are draws, it's not going to help you move up the table.
No, and listen, this happened under Louis van Gaal. Maybe not this bad, but they were drawing a bunch of games too. So what ends up being difficult for Manchester United fans is those are the games that they win. I mean, that's what Fergie time was. I mean, that's what gave birth to that phrase, which was it's 0-0, it's 1-1, it's late in the game, and the term fear factor was always thrown out. There was just a feeling that Manchester United were going to go win this game. And the opposition always felt that. You know, I talked to players that have gone and played against Manchester United, and Earl and Musto talk about it all the time. There was this sense that when they got to the last few minutes of the game that they already sort of resigned to the fact that they were going to lose that game. And that does something to the psychology of a player. And when you go into Old Trafford, there's that memory. But all the players say now, they love going to Old Trafford. I mean, teams keep getting their first wins ever against Manchester United at Old Trafford under these new managers. So I just think, I said this before we got the job, and Manchester United fans were all on my case. I said that not only because, you know, Sir Bobby Charlton and others suggested Jose Mourinho, as successful as he is, isn't the type of person that they want leading Manchester United, isn't of the ilk, isn't sort of a Manchester United man. Whether you buy that or not, they were in a tough pinch, and you go to get someone that's successful. I mean, they had already sort of messed up two hirings and needed someone that could deliver success in the short term. I just argue that I don't think Jose Mourinho is going to win a title at Manchester United. And if that's the case, you have to deal with all the negative, which is he leaves a broken thing behind him that someone else has to come and clean up. And if he does that without titles, it will not have been worth it. I mean, look at the wake of players right now of, you know, obviously some of them not being his issues, his fault, maybe the recruitment not being right. But Luke Shaw, I mean, there's just examples of players he's going to leave shattered and just shadows of themselves. And he's going to pick fights, and he's going to do all these things that is going to take time to fix when someone else comes in, although Antonio Conte kind of makes that point seem moot. But if he doesn't deliver a title, which I don't think he will for a couple reasons. One is all those other examples of when he left a club and went on to a new one. He went to a new country. He left the mess behind him and got to start anew, got to start fresh with a team that was predisposed to winning titles. This Manchester United team, I hate to break it to Manchester United fans, I'm not telling you something that you don't know, that you don't whisper to yourself when no one's in the room. They are not predisposed to winning a title. They are not one of the favorites when you come into the summer. It doesn't matter how much they spend. There's an issue there. And I worry that if Jose Mourinho doesn't win a title, it compounds that issue instead of moving them closer to being the Manchester United of old. Ooh. Just as a buzzer.
This guy.
Extra time, or did we nail that? Do we think we've got that buttoned up?
I think you got that one. Good. I mean, do you have anything more? I mean,
no.
The only thing I had a question, though, really, is Mourinho puts the system out. He puts the players out. He tells them how he wants them to play. Is there anything more they can do with all this attacking talent they do have? Pogba, Mkhitaryan, Rashford, Martial, Mata. Even if he tells them to play in a defensive way, is there anything they can do to sort of get around that so they can still have their creative freedom and just do something to make this attack better? Or are they basically stuck and have to just listen to him no matter what happens?
They just have to listen to him no matter what happens. I mean, think about what he said about Luke Shaw, going back to that one. By the way, Luke Shaw was not performing poorly when he made these comments. And so it's just hard to understand why Jose Mourinho would pick on a player that just had a close to a career-ending injury who's trying to battle back. And listen, Louis van Gaal had his issues with Luke Shaw before that, but Pochettino loved this guy, and Pochettino still loves this guy and might try to sign him in the offseason. But Jose Mourinho said, he's using my brain. He's using my brain and his body. And basically saying these guys can't figure it out and saying they're still struggling with Louis van Gaal sort of lobotomizing them and turning them into these robots that just move but don't think about the game. I mean, the reality is, in most of Jose Mourinho's teams, the Real Madrid team, the Inter team, the Chelsea team, the attacking side of things were not really because of Jose Mourinho. It was because he set them up to be very defensively sound, and he had remarkable talent, had talent that were capable of creating, had the ingenuity, had the world-class ability to fly on autopilot. They didn't really need Jose Mourinho for that, and Jose Mourinho isn't known for that. So I don't think he offers this team anything that makes them a more dynamic, more dangerous attacking side. All they can do is buy world-class quality and hope that they get the goals that in the games where they've dominated, where they have 25 shots, they haven't gotten it. And by the way, that's in a season where Zlatan Ibrahimovic was banging them in all season long. So, yeah, I think there's some issues there. And honestly, I don't think they're going to win the Europa League. And get ready for that one. Get ready for that reality check. All right, so moving on to another manager that's got an issue. Taking over a U.S. team that under Jurgen Klinsmann made strides in many areas and went backwards in many others. And one area of contention with Bruce Arena's U.S. men's national team, a question he continued to have to answer when he first took over the job, is this very delicate subject about dual nationals, and specifically the German-American players who Jurgen Klinsmann recruited and brought in. And there's one who sort of is always in the equation, always in the conversation, Jermaine Jones. And first, let's kind of paint the picture of what Bruce had to answer. A couple of quotes from Bruce suggested that, you know, it's difficult to manage these players, and having the sort of German-Americans in the locker room creates a bit of a division. Now I'm paraphrasing. This isn't exactly what Bruce said, but Tim Howard sort of echoed those sentiments, saying that, you know, when you're in a locker room, chemistry is everything. And if there are players there that aren't conducive to pulling in the same direction, that don't mesh with that chemistry, it can be an issue. And if that moves into the area of German Americans or Mexican Americans or any dual nationals having less of a right to play for the U.S. team than ones born and growing up in this country, it's absolutely wrong. That's a ridiculous statement, and I would never stand behind that statement. Where there is some veracity, and where I think there's a kernel of truth in the statement, is what's your motivation? What's your drive? I mean, do you genuinely want to put on this jersey and represent this team in the World Cup? Because if you do, I don't care where you're born, where you grew up, if you have the right to play for this country, put on the jersey, we need you. But Jermaine Jones kind of is one that always falls into this category of, if Germany came knocking, most people say he would have played 100% for the German national team, and that the ticket to the World Cup is what he cared about, not really representing the U.S. So Jermaine Jones, he takes offense to that, and you know, says that playing for the U.S. is important to him, and playing for the U.S. is something that he takes great pride in. But the problem ends up being that if that's not true, and at times it doesn't really seem like, and from being around trainings myself and speaking with guys, it seems like it is just a good ticket to a World Cup for him. And and you know, he's a very, very good player. It's just, it seemed like he would come to the U.S. and play in a way that suggested it was a level below him, where when he was playing in Champions League and he's playing in the Bundesliga, he's not trying the things. He's not trying these crazy outside of the foot, you know, weaker foot, cross field, diagonal passes that get cut out. He's not trying to be the goal scoring, you know, box to box threat that he's constantly trying to be, that leaves his center midfield partner out to dry. It just seemed like he wasn't respecting the U.S. team like he was his club team. And so if that's true, then all of a sudden you're in a locker room and you're thinking to yourself, I care so much about this team. I care so much about representing our country. I mean, my family And one of the reasons that's sort of built into someone who grew up here or lives here is, like, you know, your family's got to go to the grocery store and hear people, you know, overhear people talking about how your son played terrible in the game and they're letting you down. Or you've got to be the one that's out walking around getting all this criticism, reading the papers that are giving you a 4 rating in a World Cup qualifier. When you're someone that can just leave and completely, you know, isolate yourself and live in an echo chamber of not really being tapped into that community, whether you care about the team or not, you lose a little bit of the drive that a lot of the other players have to succeed in that team. So that doesn't mean you don't have the right to play for them, but it does create a chemistry issue where Bruce Arena isn't trying to find the best 11 players. He's trying to find the 11 that play the best together. So chemistry is absolutely everything. And by the way, there are some American internationals that I think fall into the category of they were good enough, but their dedication to the team was, or lack thereof, was the reason that they never made it. Chad Marshall. Chad Marshall is one of the best defenders the U.S. has ever produced. The reason he hasn't gone to a World Cup, the reason he hasn't been with the U.S. men's national team, is he just didn't really take it very seriously. It wasn't everything. It wasn't do or die to put on that U.S. jersey. Justin Mapp, another one. Most people won't even know that name, but Justin Mapp was one of the most talented players we had. I, when I was in U.S. camps with him when we were younger, thought to myself, this guy's going to be the next big thing. I mean, this is going to be Tab Ramos and Eddie Lewis wrapped into one. Crazy left foot, can dribble by guys. He couldn't care less about playing for the U.S. team, which is why he never got called back into camp, because Bruce sensed that. So if playing for the U.S. is just a means to an end for some other motivation, a coach, especially Bruce, will smell that out. He'll see that. So now he has a decision to make that might be made a little bit easier for him, where Jermaine Jones is hurt. He's going to be out and possibly miss the World Cup qualifiers coming up in June. I guess it depends on this MCL and how bad it is. But, you know, Jermaine Jones has been an ever-present. And let me be fair, has come up with some big performances in big games. I remember, I think he was playing off the left in that game against Ghana and doing all sorts of different roles for the U.S. team. So Jermaine Jones played in Champions League. I mean, I'm not criticizing this guy's career. This guy's a phenomenal soccer player. He's going to be up there in age. And I just get the sense that Bruce Arena, even before this knee injury, was already sort of phasing him out, kind of brought him back into camp. And he didn't perform well in the World Cup qualifier. Had to sit out the first one because suspension. And didn't really perform all that well. And it kind of... It speaks to the crux of one of the biggest men's national team problems, is he doesn't play well with Michael Bradley. Michael Bradley struggles when he's next to Jermaine Jones. For some of the reasons I mentioned before, Jermaine Jones isn't very disciplined, so Michael Bradley has to be extra disciplined. But they don't have a good chemistry. It's kind of like our Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard. It's like they just don't go well together. You know, oil and water. And Michael Bradley is much more important to the men's national team than Jermaine Jones is. So I just wonder if this is the time, because of all of those issues that I just mentioned, wherever you fall on any of those contentious problems that Bruce Arena is trying to sort out in terms of team chemistry, especially with a high-profile player like Jermaine Jones, this might be the time he's got to just cut ties with him.
Yeah, I mean, those qualifiers coming up are Trinidad and Tobago, and then Mexico is at the Azteca Stadium. So they're two really important
matches. Massive.
So who would you pick then, you know, if he is out, or even if he's just coming off of an injury, just coming back, do you think Bruce will take that risk in bringing him? And if he didn't take him, who should be that one? Who should be the player that's absent? Because the player that did fill in for him during that Honduras game where he was suspended was Sebastian Legette,
yeah.
But he is still injured.
He got
too.
The ankle injury, which was a shame because he was performing so well.
Yeah, I think
well.
He would have been the perfect person to plug in there. But
yeah. So I mean, you could adjust the system instead of playing kind of two, like a double pivot. Use Michael Bradley as a holder, and kind of like Manchester City does when they play either Fernandinho or Yaya Torre as a lone holder, and give David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne a more defensive response. Yeah, I know. Can we just do they have any link with the U.S.? No, but I mean, you could bring in a Legette and maybe a Sasha Kljestan, who I know Bruce rates, but he hasn't really gotten a consistent run in with the U.S. team. But I think what you do is go more like for like. And this is kind of, I know he's performed really well at center back, and I know Bruce likes him there. But recently, Jeff Cameron's been playing center midfield for Stoke. It's the position I know he wants to play. And in a few games, he played that with Michael Bradley. And if you go back, you know, before the last World Cup, and I love him there. I think he, and when he's given time there, more reps, I honestly think that can be an imposing, a very difficult midfield to play against. It's sort of, you know, it harks back to you know, having the Pablo Mascherainis and sort of the midfields that we used to enjoy in the past that were very hard-nosed, that were so difficult to play against.
John O'Brien, right?
Yeah, I think it frees up Michael Bradley a little bit. I know that's a little outside the box, and that creates, you know, we sort of cut off our nose to spite our face because we create another problem with that one at the center-back position where we don't really have the U.S., a center-back pairing that's consistent.
Brooks and Gonzalez or no?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would go with, but Omar Gonzalez, and Bruce knows well, has had his issues with consistency. I think he's more consistent since he's gone to Mexico, really, really performing well in Liga MX. But I want to see Jeff Cameron there. I do. I don't think it – well, I shouldn't say I don't think it's going to happen. I think Bruce sees that he solves a bigger need at center-back than they have – at center midfield. But the big thing will be if Jermaine Jones is fit, is he called in to these next qualifiers? And you know, Jermaine Jones actually came out, he hits Twitter frequently, and you know, if he gets wind of this podcast, Jermaine, I know you're gonna hit me up on Twitter at Kyle Martino if you're wondering what it is. But but yeah, he doesn't take kindly to criticism, which has increased a lot lately about his performances for the U.S.
He might not like this question. I was going to ask you to kind of wrap this up. You brought up he played very well in the World Cup. He scored that great goal against Portugal that everybody remembers. Is he living off of that World Cup performance? Has he been that good his entire time with the U.S. or since then? I mean, the one thing we just got to remind people is he's 35 right now. He's going to be 36 next year. Is he living off of that reputation? Is that why he still keeps getting spots over other guys? Does that play into it?
That a little bit. But listen, he's struggling with the Galaxy right now, but the Galaxy are struggling in general. He came into New England Revolution in Colorado Rapids and helped lead those teams to remarkable playoff runs. So I have to go back. I know this sounds like a scathing criticism of Jermaine Jones. I have to go back to he is a very good player. He absolutely is. He's going to be up there in age. And I do think there's some chemistry issues. In a vacuum, do you take Jermaine Jones? Absolutely. But there's myriad reasons why he becomes a challenge to fit into the U.S. national team picture. And that challenge gets worse and worse as time goes on. And I just think that he lived off of that World Cup, you know, probably game and a half performances that he's still enjoying some credit from. But he also was given some remarkable benefit of the doubt from Jurgen Klinsmann that I think created another chemistry issue in the locker room. Was people thought that there was a bit of favoritism in how Jurgen Klinsmann overlooked some glaring incompatibility and also some motivational issues with Jermaine and some other players that just didn't really seem to be putting in the sort of effort that that other guys were on a regular basis. So I think, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens in this next World Cup qualifier. The bigger problem is there's no, and you this sort of went to your first question, there is no obvious answer for Jermaine Jones, which is why any time with a national team you see, you know, I'd probably put Clint Dempsey in that category. You know, Clint Dempsey's come back and been excellent, but just sort of illustrates how reliant we are on Clint Dempsey, who's going to be up there in age when we get to a next World Cup. But there's no, you know, with how Clint's performing, how do you replace him? So that's U.S. Men's National Team. That's the three topics for the pod this week. Thanks for listening, Tab Potters. And also, we're doing this FaceTime Live thing. It's fun.
Facebook Live.
Did I say FaceTime Live again? Let's do a FaceTime Live as well next time. Let's just get one of the, maybe this is the phone number that this guy put in on his review, and we're going to FaceTime Live you next time. But no, Facebook Live, we're going to be doing it during the pod. So, this is a weird situation where you're going to listen to this pod later, so you're not really hearing this right now as you're listening on Facebook. I don't even know how to explain
that.
You
can go back and watch it, though.
That gets weird. You can go back and watch it, but hit me with questions on Facebook Live. What we're going to do is after we wrap up the Tad Pod, we're going to sit and answer some questions for about 10 or 15 minutes. PJ, good to have you back. Tad Potters, always good to be talking with you guys. Hit me with questions. Hit me with reviews. But if you do anything, Tad Potters, stay on your feet.